Quarantia in Conversation. Q Conversations offer the chance for me, Mark Mennell, to sit down and chat with a range of fascinating people about the things that matter to them most. A few weeks before Christmas in 2013, I had the chance to meet up with Elizabeth Berridge, or Baroness Berridge of the Vale of Catmose in the County of Rutland, to give her her full title, to meet Elizabeth at her Westminster offices on Millbank, just opposite the House of Lords. Her background is that she was a trained barrister whose career took a very different course in 2006 when she became Executive Director of the Conservative Christian Fellowship, a group that works within Conservative Party headquarters. Now, she had actually run for Parliament for the Tories in what was the safe Labour seat of Stockport before that, but it was good experience. She never expected to win. But then, completely to her surprise, after 5 years or so in the job with the CCF, she was given a life peerage in 2011, making her then the youngest woman in the House of Lords, although that's a record that's now been overtaken when Martha Lane Fox was elevated. Elizabeth has many interests, but in particular, she chairs the All-Party Group on International Religious Freedom. And it was a joy to sit with her and chat about that, and also her faith, her work, and some of the things that, frankly, are very peculiar about working in the House of Lords in Westminster. Well, Elizabeth, thank you very much for your time.
No, it's a pleasure. It's
great
a pleasure.
To be with you here. And I thought I'd start just by asking what gets you up in the mornings.
Well, before the obviously the obvious answer of the alarm clock, but yeah, I mean, it is usually I've got the alarm has gone off, I've got something to do for the day, and some purpose to get me out, which does make me, on my better days, reflect on the fact how difficult it is for people who haven't got work. Mm-hmm. That work does provide you with that routine to the day, and that is really healthy and gives you that drive and that structure. But yeah, I'm in a, on my better days, you know, I'm aware that I have, as when we swear the vote to come in, a voice, place and seat. Mm-hmm. So I have a voice that I can use and a role that I can use to speak on behalf of other people. Mm-hmm. And so however scared I am sometimes about speaking up, I try and remind myself that it's a real privilege and that people need me to speak up for them.
So was public speaking then always part of your agenda or hopes or ambitions? I mean, is that something you would do at school quite a bit? And
yeah, I mean, I was a barrister before I mm-hmm. came into the House. But that's a very different type of public speaking. I wouldn't say I was a natural at cross-examination. And so within public speaking, I've learned that there are different things that people are comfortable with. You know, give me a classroom full of children, I will freeze. I'm not very good in that environment. But yeah, I did quite a lot of talks, began to do talks at school, and then, yeah, just enjoy that. Always find it strange that people would want to hear what you've got to say, because it is a real privilege, and it's people's time, and they want to hear what you've got to say. But yeah, I do enjoy that communication, but it took me quite by surprise. I think the first proper talk I did, I'm trying to be accurate here, yeah, was when I came back from Africa, and I came back to my little local church, about 100 people in a rural community, and I just
was in Rutland.
In Rutland, yeah, and I just splurged out what I'd learnt and what happened to me whilst I was in Ghana. And I obviously wasn't trained in public speaking, so I wasn't paying that much attention to the audience except the few nice smiley faces that you always look for, you know. And at the end, when I sort of, you know, put my papers together, I looked around and people were crying, and I was like, oh my goodness, what? And
what did you say?
Yeah, what I said, what's going on here? But they were just, because they had all been, you know, supporting me whilst I was out there, and to see that I'd had such an amazing experience and learned so much when I was out there was for them. So I think that was my first wake up of like, oh, I might have an aptitude for doing this.
But I suppose also, you know, getting out of bed in the morning, it's not just sort of the duties and the opportunities, it's the sort of passions as well. I mean, are you excited about coming into Westminster in the morning and thinking,
Or are you in fear and trembling, or both? Or
I think it can be both. I do sometimes still, you know, metaphorically pinch myself that here am I, I'm walking down the road, and this is my office, and this is the place that I get to come and work, and it's an amazing place, and you are steeped in history, clearly, when you're walking around the building. Sometimes it's, though, I wouldn't say fear and trembling, it's the sense of responsibility. Mm. You know, if you've got the government minister there to engage on a particular subject, and you need your colleagues to turn up, and it's your reputation on the line of the work you're doing. And I know that sounds a bit sort of strange, because the issues that they're raising with that minister are so much more important, but you do feel that sense of responsibility. But ultimately, responsibility right down the chain to, I mean, I chair the all-party group on international freedom of religion or belief, about basically religious and non-religious persecution, in terms of persecution of atheists overseas. And you are aware that in amongst all of the work that's going on their behalf, you are a little chink in that, and you really want to do that well. And one of the things that has surprised me, because of, you know, the reputational issues that parliamentarians have had over the last few years, is particularly overseas, people do listen to what we say, and people are so encouraged if it's being raised in the British Parliament. So I feel that responsibility, which gets me over the fear. It's kind of like I have to remind myself this is a real privilege to stand up. I think everybody, many of my colleagues have said, they standing up in that chamber is not something that comes without nerves.
No, I can quite imagine. Well, perhaps we'll come back to that cross-party group in a minute, but let's sort of backtrack.
Yes,
and you are a member of the Conservative Party.
I am, yes.
And you ran the Conservative Christian Fellowship.
I certainly did for five years. Yeah, just over.
What led you into getting involved with that? I mean, presumably you sort of did some activism for them or something, or how did that happen?
I was their director for just over 5 years. Before that, though, I'd been a trustee for about 18 months. I took that unusual step of going from governance into executive operational level. I'd always thought, though, that I would have a role in government. I'd always very clear.
So is that why you went into the law?
Yeah. Well, no. Yes and no. I basically wanted to do a degree. I went to university in, 1991. I wanted to do a degree that would get me a job. Mm. I knew that I needed a job. I needed to be able to support myself. And so I went for a degree that I knew could lead to a job, whether that was in law or police or whatever.
Mm.
So it was a good degree to do to get a job. So it wasn't much about, did I enjoy the subject? It was law or give me a job at the end of it.
And did you enjoy the subject?
I did, yes. I did really enjoy it at the end. Parts of it I enjoyed. When I look back, I was much better at the broader principle law than the black letter law. So I was much more at ease with constitutional law, jurisprudence, than I was at black letter contract law. Just I'm more, you learn these things about yourself as you go along. But no, so I always had this view that I was going to have some role in government. But then I did think that law would be that role, and then I got to be a barrister, loved it, but realised I don't want to be a judge, I don't want to be a QC, but don't have the aptitude either, neither the passion or the personality. To be a judge, I believe you've got to be very content with your own company, because you don't see any real human beings except for the usher.
There's a loneliness of command in a way, isn't there?
Yeah, you have to be. The judicial role is that isolation from the participants in that sense. So you can go for a whole day and the people in front of you are there in a professional capacity. So the only person who would just say, or you can have a joke with, is the usher. And that's your daily.
And if the usher doesn't have a sense of humour, you're done.
Yeah, or you don't happen to get on with it. But it is, so I think that's also maybe also why there's a lot of collegiality in those workplaces around the lunch table, because it's a role that is set back from normal human contact that you'd have in an office like this, of chatting to any and everybody who's around the place. So I knew, it was really personality as well. I thought, I could think of nothing worse actually than being a judge. I'd find it really lonely. So I didn't want to do that. But then I got involved in local politics, and I actually joined the Conservative Party after I joined the CCF. I tried to join the party, and I think that my phone call the day after the 1997 election to their HQ was viewed as a hoax. But I genuinely wanted to join, because I thought, oh my goodness, no, this is all going to be terrible. I want to join the Tories. But then I got hold of the CCF stuff, and so I joined that, and then it was through that that I then joined the party. So I've been involved in it for a while, and as I say, become a trustee and stepped into
it. That was an interesting time to become a Tory then, wasn't it?
Yeah. I can't say I do things that are trendy, really, no. or to be popular, but it was really, as well, as a result of being at Bar School, and I dined. You had to still do those certain number of dinners. I sat next to a friend of a friend who turned out to be a guy called Jeremy Wright, and we just got talking about politics, and I, you know, didn't think I was a Tory at all, but he said, what do you believe, what do you think? And I told him, he said, I think you're a wet Conservative. And I was like, what?
Don't be so rude.
Yeah, no, it's just like, you know, because I knew I'd studied government politics, I thought, no, I'd always not, because I grew up near Corby. You know, Oakham is not that far from Corby, and I have childhood memories of going to Corby when steelworks are closed and...
Devastation.
For sale signs as long as you could see from the car. And we went there to shop because it was cheap. That's what happened to Corby. And so there was this... And the individualism that was rampant there during those years, I really rejected. But then when I explained what I did believe, James said, no, you're a Tory. So I began to then look and I thought, well, yes, actually I am. I'm a small state, pro-community... Mm-hmm. person, and Jeremy actually ended up as an MP and is now a government minister, so it's quite funny that people who have a chat with you along the way.
So was he in the CCF?
No.
You just...
No, this was when I was at Bar School, just chatting over one of those dinners. Happened to be a friend of a friend, and that was it. So Jeremy Wright is the reason I discovered that I was a Conservative. I don't know if I've ever told him that. But yeah, that was
it's out there now.
Yeah, it was like those pivotal moments. I think, yeah, because I knew what I believed, but I couldn't put it. So I did join the party, though, on a very much a point of political theory. I believe in a small state, and that's, you know, but I'm, you know, large community, large social fabric and stuff, and large role for the family. I'm not an individualist like that. So to me, but I which apparently is not always the reason people join a particular party.
So a few years down the track from that, then you get sort of sucked into CCF and being director and stuff. Was that a sort of frustration of ambitions in a way, or was it part of them? Because you stood for Parliament, didn't you?
I stood for Parliament in 2005 in a safe Labour seat that remained a safe Labour seat after my attempt at it, but great experience. But no, I mean, I'm a Christian, and I believed that was very much the move I had to make at that time. It was a lot about giving up. You know, I gave up. I had a really lovely house. I had a beautiful car. I had a Volkswagen Beetle 1.8 turbo. It was fantastic. It was really fantastic. And gave up, like, my social circle. I had a really wide social circle. Was a member of a local church. Loved Chambers, you know. Not necessarily so much the work sometimes, but I loved my colleagues. You know, had a real kind of... And I gave that up and came into London. So I just thought, no, this is the right step. It didn't look like the right step in lots of ways, but... I thought, no, actually, this is the right step to go down and do this work.
And did you feel a sort of experience difference of actually now working for something that was explicitly Christian? Did that make a sort of difference?
Yeah, I mean, I'd never done that before. No. I didn't, because I...
Was that an added pressure in a way?
I don't think I really saw it like that. Obviously, it says to everybody, it's a bit like wearing a dog collar, like you do. It says to everybody, you are a Christian. But I, you know, I wasn't a naturally at home, I suppose, in being in that employed Christian capacity, so to speak. But yeah, you are very well aware that you've got a label on everywhere you walk around the office. And, you know...
Because the CCF was in headquarters.
Yeah, all the party groups, the main parties have similar organisations, they're all hosted within the HQ. So yes, you carry with you the credibility, as you do, you know, the credibility of what people might think. You might be the only interaction they have with Christianity. With a lot of my friends, I might be the only interaction they have with a Tory. So that's also... So it's the same thing. But yeah, you're very acutely aware of your relationships with people, how you're behaving, and particularly how you handle it when, you know, you get things wrong and, you know, there's no point in pretending when you've got something wrong, because everyone can see it, you know. Mm. And you know, open plan offices are a really good thing for exposing all our follies. And it's also about how you handle that, and are you prepared to apologise to your staff for your own mistakes in front of everybody else? Is a really good test of, it's no use covering it up. Mm. We could see them, you know. Maybe it was a little bit irritable and spoke to her out of a bit of an irritation rather than, you know, anything else. Mm. We've all done it. Mm. But yes, it is. But no, I enjoyed my time there, because we existed very much in the organisation by the strength of our relationships with people. Mm. In the office, because there was no contractual basis to keep us in the office, except were we adding value for the party. Mm. Was the measure, really, I think.
And that was the direct cause, was it, of being given a life peerage? Was it sort of as part of services to the party? And
you're never properly... I never asked, maybe, or you're not told, but no. I just was, you know, quite out of the blue, obviously, and because I'm one...
Had you had any inkling it was coming?
Not at all.
No.
I was the most shocked. My reaction when I was asked, thankfully, the Prime Minister does do those calls, but I got his Chief of Staff for various reasons. My immediate reaction was me, a much larger and more shocked
yes.
reaction than I've just said.
Yes.
Because, no, I mean, it was absolutely nowhere in my thinking at all, because I just didn't... The only way in which I thought about it was to suggest other people.
Mm.
I had actually written a letter, two letters to people who I thought might be in charge of that process. I didn't even know what the process was, about people I'd met during my time at CCF.
Mm.
So, and partly it was... You just assume that if you're going to go into politics, you'll be in the Commons. And also because I'm very young, and was very young when I came in, relative to, you know, most of my colleagues have...
Retired.
The average age at the moment is 70.
Yes.
Mm. So they're also at a different stage of their career. You know, they've generally, a lot of them have done their career. Some people have still got very big commitments outside the house, but there's a lot of people who've done their career. And
has that been difficult?
It is challenging. I have found it at points quite challenging because everybody's kind and
the civility,
and I'm treated as a peer.
Mm.
You know, I am treated as an equal. There's no question about that. But you're at a different stage of life. You know, you want to change things. You want to see things. And you just see things differently. I think maybe it's a recent thing in our culture, but there is very much a generational cohort attitude strata, mm-hmm. for want of better words, developing. And I obviously see the world through the point of view of being between generations X and Y. You know, they are the war years, some of them still, or the baby boomers. And it's just a different way of... It's probably a mini culture within our culture that we're now having. So you just... see the world differently, and many of them, in a very kind way, you say, when you speak, it's just like hearing my daughter, because I'm a different generational cohort. I will come with that perspective. So, and also, sometimes I just feel I walk too quickly everywhere, because I just do bump into, because I'm very kind of, I'm just, that's what I'm busy about, my task, whatever, which for some of them... that's not their stage of life. And also, it is obviously the balance of recognising you are a peer, but recognising that you have the privilege of being in an environment where there's an enormous amount of wisdom and expertise there that I can't acquire because I'm not 70.
Mm.
You know, that's just the very nature of life. I don't have it because I'm not 70.
So is your hope then is to find... a number of sort of niche that you say, right, I'm really going to specialise in this and this. So you choose your areas to
focus
on.
Yes, it is, because Parliament deals with so many interesting... I mean, the amount of people who come in and speak here who are at the top of their fields are some of the most interesting people you could want to come in here. And that literally is probably a daily basis if you're involved in a number of spheres. But there's too many. You have to focus. You have to specialise. So... I'm on the select committee that's called the Joint Committee for Human Rights, which is joint with the Commons, and we look at all the legislation from a human rights perspective through European Convention, but also the international obligations that we have. I also focus on policing. So I currently do the Parliamentary Police Service Scheme, so I'm out and about with the Met, which is really interesting. And then I chair the all-party parliamentary group on freedom of religion or belief, international freedom of religion or belief.
Which are not very classic Tory. As maybe the police one would be more of a Tory thing, but the you wouldn't expect the others to be so.
Well, not necessarily in the sort of perception of the Tories, but there are, but there has been quite a large transition, particularly at the other end of the corridor, because so many of the new intake who came in came from very different backgrounds, social entrepreneurs, people from different spheres. But yeah, it is sad that you can be pigeonholed on certain things in accordance with the brand. You'll find this as a vicar, they pigeonhole you that you wouldn't think this or you wouldn't be like this because of that. But no, I'm very, yeah. But then, as I say, I joined the party knowing that I was on the wet, you know, which was under Heath, very much a term on that edge of the party. So, but we've got more people now. You know, one colleague who came in this week, Lady Hodgson, who's very much involved in women's issues after conflict and international development. So there are more and more Tories who are not so classically defence or an order economy people, but who have a much broader base of issues that they are concerned about.
And the human rights and freedom of religion issues, they were presumably big in your agenda before you came into the House, were they, or not so much?
Not so much. I mean, more of what I'd... there was, you know, obviously some involvement in human rights that came in whilst I was at the bar. But no, they are really things that I've picked up when I've come in. I mean, I was put on the Joint Committee by the, you know, by the party. They asked me to do that. So that has been, again, fabulous experience. I've got 9 years of legal training, but I sit alongside the likes of Lord Leicester, who, you know, basically wrote the Race Relations Act. And yes, in fact, only this week I looked and I thought, I'm sitting between Anthony Leicester, Lord Leicester, and Helena Kennedy. Wow. You know, because it is, they are such...
they've been names for years.
Yeah, and it's a real, it is a real privilege. And of course, then the challenge for me is to make my contribution and not be overawed by the fact, here are... And that is just one of the things that happens to you. But I think particularly in the Lords... Because it has focused a lot, not just on the party politics, but we've got people who are experts in all kinds of things, and I think that there is an informal kind of strategy of keeping that expertise up. So we recently, a while ago, had another vet come in because the previous vet on the crossbench is getting quite elderly. We've got nurse. We've got apparently some of the, you know, you can have a private member's bill come through that you think is going to go through on the nod about something maritime, and we discover we've got two of the country's leading experts on maritime law. And in the time when I knew I was going to come in, but before I came in, I remember hearing on the radio somebody from the Lords who's the country's leading expert on treasure trove and antiquity, about finding bronze and stuffing with your metal detector. So you name a subject, whether it's a broader issue like welfare benefits, you will probably find somebody towards the top of the expertise in the House.
And that would all be lost if it was a fully elected House, wouldn't it?
Well, yes and no. That was one of the arguments around the Clegg reforms, and that's why they did end up with an appointed section, because, yeah, we've got people who make such a valuable contribution who are on the party benches but have had their time standing for election.
Yeah.
So you'll lose the likes of Norman Lamont, Nigel Lawson, that... era, Tom King, who have a lot still of wisdom to give. So you lose that. But yeah, so you would lose the expertise that's there. So on the crossbenches, you know, we have, by convention, former governors of the Bank of England, former head of the civil service, the top of the tree of the judiciary come in. So we have a lot, and former heads of the former chief of defence staff. Mm. So you would, so that's why it ended up being a cobbled...
Which, for people from outside the UK, they look at this and think this is insane. And yet
there's a whole combination of... When you actually get down to the research and look what what happens around the world in terms of bicameral situations. There's all kinds of combinations going on. Some appointed, some elected. I think it's just that people, the model that people outside their own country are often seeing is America.
Yeah.
But when you who had the advantage that they started with a blank sheet of paper, well, obviously the indigenous Indian community wouldn't say that, but they did start a nation state with virtually a blank canvas, and we don't have that luxury, and that's what makes it very difficult to bring about a change that doesn't provide for conflict between the two chambers. That's the main issue. Yes, you would lose the expertise of appointed people, but if you want to go down an elected chamber, in principle there's no objection to that, except that you've got to work out what you do, because the reason why we are the second chamber is because we don't have the electoral mandate, we don't have the power of representing the people. That's not what we're sitting there doing. And so we are secondary to them, and we know that. That doesn't mean to say we don't get them to change things and try and put a block on stuff. Occasionally we will. But once you elect me, I will be arguing with you in the corridor, because I'm elected on behalf of the of the people of this nation, and I'm going to stand up to them if I think they're wrong. And then you have to work out, which obviously is very obvious if you've got two elected chambers, you've got to work out how you solve when they disagree. And legislators around chambers around the world have got various ways they do that. Sometimes it's you form a select committee of both chambers to sort it out. Sometimes you go to back to the people and referenda. Sometimes it's a veto by the president. All kinds of ways, but you've got to have something. Otherwise, we would. And why wouldn't we get stuck? Because I would then be there representing and put there.
And actually, you know, sometimes you do look over the Atlantic and think the sort of gridlock and inertia that happens there, particularly what we've seen in the last few months, is just absolutely disastrous.
Yeah. And there is, you know, there is a great... I do spend some of my time, obviously, when people bring concerns to me, saying, this is a matter for your MP, because this isn't my... role that you've brought to me. You've brought to me a constituency concern, and so please go. So there's that deal. Whereas if I'm elected, boy oh boy, will I be racing to get to the to solve this person's problem quicker, particularly if I was in a constituency where the MP was of a different party. There'd be that. In some ways, very healthy from the point of view of the general public. Not so healthy if you're the government department trying to respond to the clamour for attention on behalf of the same constituent from a Labour MP and a Tory wouldn't be called peers then, but a Tory member of the upper chamber.
It's a fascinating classic English fudge that works, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it is a fudge, and yes, usually it works. And it doesn't mean to say that we don't need change, because we do need change in the upper house, and we know that. You know, that you can't retire. The only way you properly leave the House of Lords is to die. And that is really... it makes the lists artificially high of the numbers who can come, because it's generally within a large cohort, the same people who I see day in, day out, because I'm a working peer. But what I find the saddest thing about the system at the moment is that people are not recognised for their contribution in the Lords. I think this is one of the things that I'm told happened when most of the hereditaries were evicted. There was no proper ceremony to it. And I would like, with many of my, you know, certain colleagues who have passed away during the time I've been in the House, a short time I've been in, I think how much better it would have been for them to retire. They could have had, their family could have come in. They could have had a nice meal, obviously, their introduction. Yeah, like people retire from most workplaces. And we have the advantage of public record. So there are some colleagues who've passed away that I just think, gosh, what a shame that, unless you're going to read their whole biography, or some have not had biographies written because they don't really sell very well, actually, you're dependent on the Times obituary to cover them and tell you about them. Whereas some of the people who've passed away have been known to colleagues for decades and could have told for the sake of public record and for people, you know, because some people do, you know, look at Hansard and particularly those type of speeches, and to see on public record, this is the contribution that person made to defence, to whatever. I think that, and I just think it would honour people a lot more if, and I mean, I myself, I would just find it fascinating partly because, you know, many of my colleagues, when I first came in, we were doing the parliamentary voting and constituencies bill, and the number of times, people say, your lordships will remember the two elections of 1974, and I'm sitting there going, nope. For me, it's a quick history lesson for me. Yeah. Well, sounds a bit selfish, but I just think it's more honouring to them if they could retire.
I mean, there's clearly, and this is true of both houses, they're clearly incredibly talented people who are, in large part motivated by high ideals and, very sort of positive concerns for making a difference. Mm-hmm. And, I've met people from, both sides and you really do have a sense of that. And yet, somehow, there's just this profound sense of mistrust and suspicion about those in power, those in sort of political circles, and you keep getting these polls about whether or not people trust politicians more than the police or journalists or whatever.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that people are even more sceptical of the Lords than they are of the Commons, perhaps just because of the perception of it being hierarchical and ancient and not really keeping up with the times. That's a guess. But why do you think we've got ourselves into this sort of quagmire of suspicion?
I think it's a cultural thing. When people ask me these questions, and my reflections are that your leaders reflect your society.
Mm-hmm.
We are no different, and that's why I do at some points get slightly concerns too strong of it. I'm slightly uncomfortable with the bash with the media thing, thinking these journalists do actually, they're not some breed apart.
No, no.
And we're not some breed apart. And the things I have read about the level of honesty in society generally, and the level of trust are on a decline. A friend of mine said to me the other day, if you sit down with, middle class people around a dinner table, she said, and she had had this experience, the number of people who've put in just slightly more on the insurance claim than actually was legit. And then there was the phase during which, to get your mobile phone replaced when it was stolen, there was so much of it happening, the police gave up giving crime reference numbers, because it was such a task. And I have, young, law-abiding, ostensibly law-abiding people who've claimed for a mobile phone, it's not been nicked. And I just think, so there is an element where we are a whole people.
Mm.
When I applied for jobs, I didn't need to produce my exam certificates.
Mm.
Why on earth would you have to?
So why do you think that's happened? What is it about us?
I don't know. I think we've got this mistrust going on. We've got a breakdown of trust generally in society, whether it's trust of your neighbour, you don't necessarily know your neighbour now.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in London,
mm.
And trust generally. I think, and that has led to an over reliance on law.
Mm.
So, which I can't remember whether it might have been in a draft of my speech about the Antisocial Behaviour Bill, but we are, yes, and I think I actually was in the final version that we're asking the law not to just protect us from the crimes of our neighbour, but to try and make our neighbour be considerate. There is, I think we do get to the edge of however ingenious you can be about penalties and whatever, that what can law do to make your neighbours considerate for you? So I don't know why we're seeing that decline of, I think it may be linked to the fact that we don't have respect for institutions anymore, we don't have respect for authority, we don't see that there are actually authority structures there, and that's a good thing in society, that everybody having the vote is different from the fact that there are certain authority structures and therefore certain people in those positions whose view, in my view, does count. So, or it's more authoritative. Everybody's view counts, but it's more authoritative. So, like with my colleagues at work, something that they know their stuff, they are more authoritative. Whereas everything sometimes has become diluted down to everybody phoning into a radio talk show, but there are certain people whose opinion. Mm. Right, but I think all of that has really just, you know, declined.
It's interesting, Tom Wright makes exactly the same point about legislation in his book Virtue Reborn, because he's saying basically we've gone through a period of liberalising over the last 50-odd years, finding ourselves sort of opened up to all kinds of possibilities, and then having to re-legislate, obviously in slightly different, with slightly different boundaries, but we're trying to sort of control and bound people after the horse has bolted, almost.
Yeah, and I think the example I often use in terms of this, and I've never seen a study, but in most people's contract nowadays, you will have a whistleblower's clause. But we've seen time after time these things that are going on, whether it's in a health institution or the BBC with the phoning in after the phone lines have closed. We've not seen so many people come forward. Whereas I think previously, even when it wasn't in people's contract, people did blow the whistle. And there was this sense of, sort of like the reverse of, you know, restraining yourself and being a considerate neighbour, is when is it my role to speak on behalf of the public interest and to speak up? But yes, I think we, I mean, if you think about it, you know, we've got an obesity epidemic now, but you never hear people talking. I mean, self-restraint is not a fashionable thing to start.
In any area.
In any area. You know, disciplining yourself. Mm. And, you know, I find it myself, even though I often quote to my friends, you know, when I was working in CCHQ, just you get into the habit of just, oh, I fancy a Diet Coke, just go and buy one.
But it is a Diet Coke.
It is a Diet Coke, but that whole thing of having a desire but not fulfilling it, even if it's spending 60p, is something that trains. It's a bit like going regularly to the gym. It trains you in a, okay, I've got a desire to do that, but actually I'm not going to fulfil that. And it's like, once your will comes in and pulls back on your desire, it's like you've trained yourself to think and behave differently. But we, and we all do it, because, you know, relatively speaking, and having lived abroad, our food tastes great, whether it's for artificial reasons or not.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so, no, I think you can see there's some institutions have turned the corner. The royal family hit it first for different reasons, and I think the royal family have come out of it. The judiciary, you know, thank the Lord. You know, I went to, for the first time ever, to a old colleague who was sworn in as a High Court judge, and, you know, you hear the judicial oath. And our judiciary are not corrupted, generally. I mean, we will have little edgy bits going on, but generally, when you compare...
It's one of the last bastions, isn't it?
It is. They are there. When we need a public inquiry, who do we go to? We go to the retired High Court, the High Court judges. Mm. Our judiciary are independent and are very fiercely... And you know, you look at various other countries, even European countries, and you think, no, it's not the case over there. So they have... You know, they get critiqued for other reasons, like not being in touch.
Or wearing wigs.
Which actually, when they surveyed, the criminals want them to keep the wigs.
Yeah, well,
it's a symbol of authority, it's not a person.
Absolutely.
It's the state that is...
I completely get that.
Yeah.
Let me sort of draw things to a bit of a close. Just think about the committee that you chair.
Yeah.
And the whole issue of religious persecution and non-religious persecution. Yeah. And what have you particularly learnt from being on that committee? And obviously, steep learning curves.
Yeah.
But you've travelled around a bit and witnessed things. What has really hit home?
What has hit home is that post-Second World War, when we were at the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, we didn't really pay much attention to Article 18, which is the article. It didn't become an international convention, and therefore gather the international infrastructure to look at what was...
So was it just assumed then, do you think?
I haven't actually investigated, but there was this vacuum that was left, and that vacuum meant that a lot of things happened, and a lot of there's now a big international debate going on about blasphemy of religion, protecting religions using Article 18, when actually Article 18 is a human right of an individual and an individual within a community. It's a big debate going on there. Was that potentially given a bigger space to happen because there's a vacuum? Potentially, yes. I think, you know, that space happened. But I think also, you know, it's just sitting from the perspective of UK and Western Europe, which, you know, the rest of the world over the last 25, 30, 40 years got seriously religious. And there's now, in sociological circles, it's Western European exceptionalism. Mm. So we are also looking at the global picture through a lens that isn't very religiously literate, isn't a society that's deeply steeped in religion, when if you go to somewhere like Egypt, massively is. And so there's there is also that angle for us of looking at it. But what I have learned, you know, we have various stakeholders around the table, some humanist, Christian, Hindu, Sikh, Baha'i, Buddhist, around that table, and I have seen them work together and pull together. They disagree theologically about just about everything, totally, but they are agreed that you shouldn't be put in prison or have your, you know, be attacked because you happen to have a different belief.
And perhaps more importantly, because you've changed your belief.
Yeah. They are, I mean, that is one, obviously also one of the touch points. This has now become a very difficult, tricky human right to look at because of those issues. Yeah, that, I think that is also an issue in our own country. Have we really been clear to our own communities? You can change faith. You know, that's what it is about being in the UK. I'm not confident or sure about domestic context. But yes, I mean, they are, and that has been immensely refreshing, and not something I predicted. I thought I'd have all kinds of trouble bringing together such a disparate group, but actually they are fantastic and increasingly wanting to speak on behalf of each other. And as someone who is a Christian, I've been really appreciative of the support from the different stakeholders. But we talk about the church more generally, you know, I'm sad that we're not at the vanguard of this.
Yes.
You know, we really should, you know, we've got a couple of obviously institutions like the Anglican Church and Catholic Church that are global, you know, that we should be at the vanguard of fighting for this freedom with every ounce of our breath on behalf of everybody. And I think there is increasing realization that actually this is our role, to do it on behalf of everybody. But it's a mammoth task. You pick up something like this, and we're so aware that actually what we've picked up is probably 20, 25 years' work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's different. That's difficult because I'm very much an action person. I have to learn this is a marathon. It's not a sprint.
So how do you respond to people who say there's a lot of persecution of Christians in the UK?
It's not persecution. It demeans the word. And that's what has also happened in our culture. We've overused words and applied them, and our vocabulary is losing its objective kind of sense. And I've really seen that very postmodern view to vocabulary. This is not persecution. You know, persecution is what you hear happening in Egypt. Persecution is, for anyone listening to this, to go and Google Rohingya Muslims on Google Images. That is persecution, and don't do that if you're under 18. That is persecution. You know, this is not persecution, and I think we need to respect. Yes, there are people who now feel, as a result of their faith and their conscience, that they can't do certain jobs, etc. But we are in a position here, as well as the church, if there are people are in that situation, to take care of them. You know, to provide them, you know, I can understand the decisions certain people have felt they've had to make, but it's the church's responsibility to support that person for 6 to 9 months to let them get another job. You know, we need to recognise that. I also think what fundamentally I want to see in response to the situation in the UK is the response that I have seen from people such as the Coptic Church in Egypt, Bishop Angelos. You know, the Pope in Egypt, when their churches are being burnt, said, let them burn, we give these for the nation. For the sake of Egypt, we give these. And having visited the church in Alexandria, where there was the bombing just before the revolution, and seen and met those leaders, you know, you are to love your enemies. You know, you not necessarily give them a lawsuit, you know.
Yeah.
It's how to overcome that kind of evil, and it is evil. But I do, you know, it's very, you know, obviously, you know, when certain people I know, a Catholic gentleman, went to visit the atheist who's in prison in Indonesia, I mean, that is what we should be doing. We should be able to learn to respond to the culture that maybe, or the law that isn't how we would perhaps want it to be, in a way that is an overcoming, gracious, loving response. There, the graciousness of those who have, and the non-retaliation in Egypt is quite something. Really, it really is.
Well, I think that's a good note to end.
Yeah, no, that's great.
So, Elizabeth, great. Thank you very much.
No, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you would like to find out more about Elizabeth's work or about some of the other conversations I've had, then check out my blog, markmennell.wordpress.com, or just simply search for Quarentia in Conversation on iTunes. Until next time, though, thanks very much for listening.